universe that we have not seen. You know how they show those like cross sections of the atmosphere, and they show the place of the earth in the heavens, and we live on this tiny little film of atmosphere. Above that, there's the troposphere, the ionosphere, the mesosphere. And we think that we're so aware of everything. But there are worlds and marvels and stuff that eye has not seen nor ear has heard. And these are things both above the earth and beneath the earth. There is stuff beneath the earth. There's the submerged chaos, which I believe is the same as Tartarus. I could be wrong about that. But there are worlds. You take a telescope, you point it in the sky, and there's no end. It just keeps going. The more powerful telescopes we build, the more we realize that this world just keeps going. On the other end of the universe, you can get the most powerful microscopes and look down, 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 down into creation. And you realize that there's more there than we've ever dreamed. We haven't found the end of it, either up or down. And it was only recently that we discovered some of the things on our own planet. Speaking chiefly of the sea, the ocean. It took us a while to discover what was in the ocean. We sent explorers there like Jacques Cousteau. He went down into the briny deep with his son Philippe off the boat Calypso. And they showed us weird stuff down in the ocean. Stuff with glow-in-the-dark antennas and weird eyes and no eyes. Then they sent up the Hubble telescope, of course. No, Jacques Cousteau didn't do that. Neither did Philippe. Apparently they named it after some guy called Hubble. And we see farther into the universe than we've ever seen. And it just keeps going. But like I said, there are probably spots on our planet we've never been. Sights unseen. Species yet uncovered. Who knows if there's maybe a Triceratops running around somewhere. I don't think so, but only in the last century did folks really take a look at Antarctica and the North Pole. I say all this as an introduction to the remainder of chapter 19 in Revelation, which I'm going to read to you now. I'm a little subdued about it, but that's okay. I don't hide my moods from you. I don't hide anything from you. I just come at you here. So I left off on Friday freaking out about the juxtaposition of a wedding feast with carnage of human bodies on earth. And the groom at this beautiful ceremony having a sickle coming out of his mouth, fire in his eyes, a blade issuing out of his mouth, I should say, a sharp blade, that with it, he should be smiting the nations. There's a hell of a wedding reception for you. I've been at some wild wedding receptions, but this one takes the wedding cake. Verse 15, and he will be shepherding them, that is, nations, with an iron club, and he is treading the wine trough of the fury of the indignation of God. Here, wine is a type of a crushed grape, and it's a type of human bodies being smashed and their goo coming out. The goo is going to come out of human beings, the gore. Just like the gore of a wine comes, of a grape comes out when you tromp it, stomp on it, tromp it in the wine press. That's basically what it sounds like. That's a close-up. Wait a minute. That's it. That's it. Probably a human body sounds the same way. Maybe you have to do it more like this. I don't know. Something along that line. But that's the analogy here. Treading the wine trough. Of the fury of the indignation of God. Now, when human beings tread on grapes in a wine trough, they're not mad at them. They just stomp the heck out of them because they want the wine. They're not mad at the grapes. But in the analogy, Christ is rather upset at the nations for coming against his people. But it's an emblem of God's assumption. Christ, interesting passage. I think it's Hebrews 11:3. Christ is the emblem of God's assumption. God assumes different attitudes depending on the situation here. I'm going to go to that verse because I think it's so important now. It's coming to me as we speak on this. The emblem of God's assumption. I thought it was in Hebrews 11 at the beginning here. Let's see. No. Maybe it's right at the beginning of the book of Hebrews. This is important. I'm going to go through this with you because many people will think that. Yeah, here it is. Many people will think that the God of Revelation is the essence of the true God, and Jesus Christ is portraying the essence of the true God. Well, this would be my question to those people who think that the God of Revelation is the quintessential God, is that, did you not see Jesus Christ at the Last Supper, dining with his disciples and the Apostle John, resting his head on his Lord's breast? And we see a gentle solicitude of Jesus Christ for his friends. And we see in the same Gospels, Jesus Christ saying to Philip, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. Jesus Christ was such a perfect image of the Father. And so my takeaway there is that Jesus Christ, being a lamb, proves that God is also a lamb. Abba Martin, we're not seeing the lamb in the unveiling chapter 19 when he's treading the wine trough and a sickle, a sharp sickle, comes out of his mouth to cut down the nations. No, we're not. But that's another assumption of God's. God assumes different roles for a purpose, to teach lessons. Again, I use the analogy of a parent because it's such a good analogy. A parent smites his child with a wooden spoon. Does that mean if you took a snapshot of that? I mean, you could. You know, somebody could take a snapshot of that image or a video and then publish that video and say, look at this parent abusing his child. And this occurs for this discipline occurs for maybe 20 seconds. And you don't see, and it's not shown, the other 23 hours and, you know, 59.8 minutes of the day when the parent is loving the child and doting over the child and reading books to the child, kissing the child goodnight, stroking the hair of the child. You don't see that because we're only looking at a snapshot. All right, so at the beginning of this series, I told you in the scope of the Aeonian times, 7 years is a very, very short amount of time. Brief candle compared to the eons. But God, in his mercy, cuts that 7 years in half. And he says, I'm not going to torment the earth for 7 years. I'm going to cut it back. I'm going to cut it in half, and I'm going to only torment for 3.5 years. Seriously, come after you. So even compared with the 1,000 years, which is the fruit of the child pains, the birth pangs of the 7 years, the first 3.5 years of that 7 year period. No, oh yeah, my point there was, this 7 years buys you 1,000 years. That's a theme, right, that I brought to you over and over again. This 7 year period buys you 1,000 years of bliss. That's a great trade-off. But when you compare that 7 years to the Aeonian times, which is far more than 7 years, it's possible that the fifth eon, the eon after the millennium, is 25,000 years in duration. The time period before The tribulation, the 7-year period, just since the creation of Adam, was 6,000 years. But before that, there was the first earth that was disrupted. We don't know how long that was. Maybe that was 10,000 years. We don't know. We just don't know. But what I'm trying to show you is that 7 years is a drop in the Aeonian bucket. Now, God even halves that time. He says, I'm only going to do it for 3.5 years. Bad, because I'm a loving, careful God. I'm a surgical incisionist, and I'm going to be careful. Okay, now what I'm telling you, and I'm telling myself this at the same time, because as you know, last week I got disturbed about this, is that he even cuts down the 3.5 years, and he's only stomping on the grapes at the very tail end after the nations have done their worst and they gathered against Israel to smite Israel and to eliminate Israel off the face of the map. It's only during this short time that the sickle comes out of the mouth, the eyes go up in flames, and the wine trough is trodden by Christ with God's approval. Here's the verse in Hebrews, chapter 1, verse 1. By many portions and many modes of old, God speaking to the fathers in the prophets, that's the way God used to speak. He never spoke audibly, he spoke through people. And if a voice shows up, it's the voice of an angel giving God's words. God is inaudible and invisible, and always will be inaudible and invisible. That's why he needs intermediaries. He chooses to need intermediaries. They make his ways and his words and his means known to us. Jesus Christ is one of those intermediaries, other angels, other messengers. And we're being told in Hebrews chapter 1:1 that God speaks to the fathers and the prophets. Prophets, these lonely, rural, lower caste, loser individuals spoke the words of God. But in the last of these days, verse 2, Hebrews chapter 1, he speaks to us in a son. So now finally his expression is being perfected. Prophets were okay for their time, for their era, but they weren't perfect. Even though God inspired them, now he's going to give his true heart. He's going to unveil his true nature to a son, whom he appoints enjoyer of the allotment of all. He appointed Jesus Christ to enjoy the allotment of everything. That is ownership. The ownership, allotment, a lot, a special portion of what? The special portion is the universe. And the details of that are in Colossians 1, 16 through 20, of how Jesus Christ inherits all things, because he is the creator of all things. He's first the creator, then he goes to the cross, then he's the inheritor, and he brings everything back to him richer because of the crucifixion, because of his death buying everyone back, coming back richer, and taking away sin. That little detail, forgot to mention that. So he appoints him, God appoints Christ, you're the one, appoints him, enjoyer of an allotment, through whom he also makes the eons. What a great verse. I don't know how the King James ruins this. By the way, I must say this. If you're an expositor in the Word of God, and you're using the King James Version indiscriminately, then you are doing a disservice to the people of God. Now, sometimes I will use a paraphrase of the Scriptures, but I only do it when that paraphrase does not clash with a literal rendering. So I compare the paraphrase with the literal rendering. Sometimes the literal rendering is practically unusable because it's so esoteric and obliquely put forward that I will use the paraphrase, but I will make sure that it doesn't go against the literal meaning. But if you're using the King James Version to teach, and you're using that as your default scripture, then you will, by virtue of that bad translation, be misleading people. Because it's all about sound words. And when sound words are important, we must go to either the concordant literal New Testament or the Devar translation. Young's literal is all right. Those are the only three versions I would really trust. The Devar translation, the concordant literal New Testament, which I have here, and Young's literal is not bad. So Jesus Christ makes the eons. I think the King James has worlds, through makes the worlds. No, he makes eons. He makes those periods of time during which God is revealing himself. Christ does all these things. Great. Who, speaking of Christ, who, being the effulgence of his glory and emblem of his assumption, Besides, carrying on all by his powerful declaration, making a cleansing of sins, is seated at the right hand of the majesty in the heights, becoming so much better than the messengers, as he enjoys the allotment of a more excellent name than they. This is what I want to tell you, is that Jesus Christ is two things here in the third verse of Hebrews chapter 1. He's the effulgence of God's glory. This is the equivalent of the corona of the sun. The corona of the sun. You have never seen the sun, ladies and gentlemen. You have never seen it. You've seen the corona of the sun. You've seen the effulgence. You've seen the glowing of the sun. It's so bright that it blinds you to the sun itself. Likewise with Christ. He's the effulgence of God's glory. God is so glorious, and we see his effulgence, his radiance in his firstborn, in his created, in the first of the origin of the creation of God, as Christ is called in Revelation 3:14. And he's the emblem of his assumption. Now, this is a interesting word. An assumption is an assumed position. And Christ is the emblem of that. An emblem is something that represents something else. The flag with the stars and the stripes is an emblem of the United States. The bald eagle is an emblem of the United States. So when you see the bald eagle, you think of our country. When you see the star-spangled banner waving, or the ramparts, then that is an emblem of our country. It represents something. It's an image. It's a reflection. So Jesus Christ is the emblem of God's assumption. And God, for his own purposes, assumes different roles at different times. He assumes roles to teach something. But if you want to know God's essence, you look at huge verses like God is love, God is spirit, God is makes his home in inaccessible light. So God is love, but he assumes different roles. In Moses' day, he assumed the role of an indignant deity, and he thundered and lightninged on Mount Sinai when Moses was up there, so the people were scared shitless, and they did not want to go up there. So that was a role that God assumed, and he carried forth that role through the mediation of messengers, and the chief messenger is Jesus Christ. So then we see him in a different role, enthroned between the cherubim in the Holy of Holies in the temple. That's another role that he plays. He's the settled deity that's guarding over Israel. We see his role in the four animals that worship at the throne. God is to be worshipped. And we see his role as a loving, caring God when Jesus Christ is on earth with the disciples. And now we see his role as a God who takes note of evil and takes note of those who go against him. And we see him as a disciplining parent here. And we see him as someone who appears to treat life so cheaply that he can snuff it out. He did it at the time of Noah. He snuffed out great amounts of life. We see it in the unveiling. He's snuffing out great amounts of life. But it's like my grandpa said to me when I was 10 years old and I stepped on a turtle accidentally, a little pet shop turtle in a little plastic bowl. I smashed the thing. It sounded like that. And I cried into my grandfather's lap, and I said, "What did I do? What did I take from existence?" And my grandpa said, and I asked him, "Grandpa, what are turtles made of?" He said, "Turtles are made of turtle material." Pure genius, my grandpa. Grandpa Lloyd, my dad's dad. Turtles are made of turtle material. In other words, kid, there's plenty more where that came from. There's plenty more where that came from. So God is so able to bring back to life, and he says, "I kill and I make alive." But he can snuff out life. He can trump the wine press. And by the way, these people are dying at this time. If you get smooshed, you're dying. And it's not like you're being tormented. We're going to see who's going to be tormented here. But it ain't the grapes. Okay? It ain't the grapes. And it's not the many combatants who align against Israel at the extremity of this eon. But they're smooshed out of existence. You can quote me on that. Smooshed. I'm using a paraphrased version of the scripture. That's the Zender paraphrased version. The ZPV. That's good. I like the ZPV. The ZPV. That's got a nice ring to it, eh? We'll be right back.